Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say I think we're joined for the first time by Dr. Derek Scissors. He is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he specializes in Asian economic issues. He is the author of the China Global Investment Tracker and also Chinese Investment in the U.S. Dataset. He teaches at George Washington University about the Chinese economy, and we're anxious to pick his brains about it, among other relevant issues that that bear on both our own economic interests and arguably national security as well. Dr. Derek Scissors, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
I don't know where to start. There's a number of things that I'd love to kick around with you. Maybe we could begin with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You've expressed some concerns about it as I read it. I think I share them. Talk a little bit about why this may not prove out to be the great white hope of America in the Asian Pacific Rim.
There are two criticisms of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. One is the protectionist criticism that says the U.S. can't compete, we shouldn't lead, we should, you know, kind of withdraw to an economic fortress America. That is not mine. Mine is I want the U.S. to lead. I do think we can compete. I do think we want as open markets as possible. And when markets are open around the world, the U.S. does very well. So my criticism of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is not the protectionist criticism. It's the we're not leading. This is not a high-quality free trade deal, which is what the U.S. has signed. It's we're the only reason, we're the only country that really signs them, us and whoever's willing to go along. And I think it leaves gains on the table for American services companies. We're the world's biggest services exporters. And it opens the door to future continuation of current misbehavior by state-owned enterprises. The big problem there is China. China's not in the TPP, but I don't see anything in the TPP that's going to hold the Chinese back.
Well, that's one of the arguments that we've been hearing about it. In fact, the Secretary of Defense has gone so far as to say this is worth a carrier battle group because of the help that it will render in terms of holding China at bay. I guess two questions. One, you say it won't accomplish that, but is it likely, worse yet, arguably, that China will actually wind up being in this arrangement to their benefit and perhaps our detriment?
The first question, I mean, there are diplomatic gains to this. The U.S. has a trade agreement with Japan. It brings our countries together. The Chinese don't like it. So if you're talking about diplomacy, I see the point about this is a step forward for the U.S. But to me, a trade agreement isn't about diplomacy. That's why you have diplomats. On the econ side, it does not do what it was supposed to do. It does not make rules that are a big challenge for China, that China has to really up its game, become a better trade partner to follow. I do think the Chinese, if they want to join, can easily join. It's not a high hurdle for them. There might be, you know, Japan might say no, Vietnam might say no, the U.S. might say no. That's fine, but that's all a diplomatic problem.
Yeah, in fact, I think John Kerry has indicated that both Russia and China would be welcome to join this. So it seems a bit of a bait and switch in terms of how it's being presented. Let me ask you about the WTO as meeting at the moment. The Chinese performance there, and maybe this is to some extent they're doing, to some extent are acquiescent in it. But it raises a question for me, Derek Scissors, as to whether we're likely to see in things like this this reserve currency business that the International Monetary Fund has just granted them reserve currency status, and perhaps the Trans-Pacific Partnership and internet governance, the Chinese doing there what they've done in the WTO, which is kind of bend or break the rules at will, or should we be concerned on that score?
Yeah, I mean, the Chinese have an approach to this, which is, if it's good for us, we'll do it. And the cooperation with the world, and if things, you know, not really that important, unless it's convenient for us at the time, and for China. And if things change, they change. So the WTO was China really wanted to get in, and they wanted to make some concessions to get in, and they did. And after they got in, they thought, that's great, we got that, now we're going to do what we want. The Paris Agreement is the same way. The TPP would be the same way because the rules aren't strong enough to really bind them. Paris Agreement is non-binding. For example, the WTO requires consensus. You can see all of these places give China a lot of room to maneuver. And when you're talking about a small country or a country that's trying to obey the rules but is struggling because it doesn't does not have the technical capacity. Those are fine, but China's a big country, and it's not struggling to obey the rules. It's gaming the rules for its own purpose.
And again, at our expense, not infrequently.
Yeah, at everybody's expense. I think the American role here that we have failed to play on a consistent basis is there's no point saying we're making the rules if the rules don't do what they're supposed to do. That's my concern with the TPP. Well, President Obama says we need to make the rules instead of China. I agree with that, but not if we're going to make weak rules that don't do anything. The WTO requires U.S. leadership. We're the by far the most important trading country in the world because we're willing to run trade deficits when everybody else isn't. I happen to think as an economist, trade deficits mean the U.S. economy is strong. So I don't have a problem with that. But we need to use that that leadership capacity to make better rules. And when you don't make better rules, countries will game them. And China's big. And so when they game them, it hurts everybody.
On the reserve currency question, Derek Scissors, you've written that you think that this is actually going on net to benefit us rather than the Chinese. I'm wondering whether that might be so in the short term, but not in the longer term. Do you anticipate that the Chinese will move forward with this special drawing rights sort of opening with what I gather has been a long-standing objective of supplanting the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency?
Well, there's the funny thing about the dollar and the renminbi, the Chinese currency, and also the euro for that matter, and the yen, is that we seem to be winning the race by debasing our currency slower than everyone else. You know, we're trying to debase our currency, and a lot of people have been worried about that, but everyone else has done it faster, so the dollar keeps getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And what's going on with China and the U.S. is the Chinese are afraid to move their currency away from the dollar. They depend on the dollar. And so that's my point about them joining the SDR actually benefits us, is they're actually increasing the weight of the dollar in the world. Now, you could be right. The Chinese certainly have the capacity to set up an independent currency and change things, but they've been afraid to. And they have good reason, because they've trashed their own banking system. I mean, one of the things about talking about the U.S. and China is it's true both that the U.S. is not showing the right kind of leadership, and the Chinese have a lot of vulnerabilities. So if you look at one side of the equation, you think China's really taking advantage of a lot of world rules and we're not doing anything about it. You look at the other side of the equation, the Chinese are not 10 feet tall. And in banking and in finance and on their currency, they're definitely not 10 feet tall.
And Derek, let me ask you in closing, and again, our guest is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, specializing in economic affairs in Asia. As we're having this conversation, we anticipate later today the Fed will announce that it's beginning to ratchet up interest rates. What impact do you anticipate that will have on U.S. Chinese and, for that matter, U.S. Asian economic ties?
Well, it depends on whether this is real or it's just we've been talking, as you know, and I think everybody listening knows, we've been talking for months and months and months about a Fed rate increase. And if we're just going to spend all this time to talk about a quarter point increase or two quarter point increases, this just doesn't mean anything. Interest rates are at incredible lows, historic lows, and adding half a point to that doesn't do something. Now, if the U.S. were to be suddenly committed to a real price of capital that rewards people for good projects and rewards savers, that would change the way the U.S. And Asia interact, and it would be, in my opinion, to our favor. We're in an environment where money is so cheap for the people who can get it that there's no rewarding of quality. And American firms and American workers are generally better than workers and firms in other countries. So I don't think the Fed's going to do much. I think this is much ado about nothing. If we really got back to a normal interest rate environment, I think it would help the United States, and it would rebalance some of our relationships in the long term with our Asian partners.
We'll be watching this closely, as I know will you, Dr. Derek Scissors, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, the author of The China Global Investment Tracker and Chinese Investment in the U.S. Dataset. Keep up the good work, sir. Come back to us again if you would soon. I hope the rest of you come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.